All right, so have you ever thought about how millions of people flying on different airlines, paying different prices, could all team up to sue some of the biggest companies in the world?
Yeah, that's a good question. It's not easy, for sure.
Well, today we're looking at Indriana Shivdharanshu Transportation Antitrust Litigation, a case that really gets to the heart of how class action lawsuits work, especially when it comes to antitrust issues.
Yeah, and it has some really important lessons for anyone who's interested in the world of litigation, especially, for all the future lawyers out there.
Exactly. So basically, we have these four major airlines: American Airlines, Delta, Southwest, and United. They're all facing some pretty serious allegations of price fixing.
Right. And in this deep dive, we're going to get into what those accusations are, how the court decided whether all those passengers could sue together as a class, and what this all means for antitrust cases moving forward.
Okay, so let's jump right in. We have these four airlines and two main accusations against them. The first one is that after that big recession back in 2009, they all conspired to limit how many seats they were offering.
Yeah, that's what's called capacity discipline in the industry. The idea is that if you reduce the supply, prices go up.
Less supply, higher prices. Makes sense in a basic econ 101 kind of way.
Exactly.
And then the second accusation is that they were using their hub and spoke systems to kind of fix prices in a more roundabout way.
Yeah, that's right. So these airlines, they dominate traffic at their big hub airports, right?
Right, yeah.
And they can all see each other's prices through these shared reservation systems. So the plaintiffs are saying they use that to coordinate without having to, actually meet up and make a deal.
So it's more like they're sending signals to each other through their pricing, using the technology that's already there to avoid direct competition.
Exactly. And that's a really interesting aspect of this case because the court saw these two accusations as separate but potentially overlapping conspiracies. So to win their case, the plaintiffs had to prove each one, separately with different evidence.
Interesting. So let's break it down. Starting with that capacity discipline claim, how did the plaintiffs try to prove that these airlines were deliberately reducing the number of seats available?
Well, they presented a ton of economic data showing how, after 2009, all four airlines significantly reduced their capacity, almost in lockstep with each other.
Ah, so it wasn't just one airline deciding to fly fewer planes, but all of them doing it at roughly the same time. And that looks suspicious, right?
Exactly. Their argument was that this synchronized reduction in capacity was too big, too coordinated, to be explained just by the recession. It pointed towards collusion.
Okay, I'm starting to see the picture here.
And this really shows how important economic analysis is becoming in these kinds of cases.
Yeah, it seems like you can't just say, oh, look, they're all doing the same thing, must be collusion. You need hard data to back it up.
Absolutely. You need to show that the market behavior can't be explained by normal economic factors.
Right. Now, what about that second allegation, that whole hub and spoke thing? That seems a lot more subtle. How do you even begin to prove that?
Well, as we touched on earlier, the hub and spoke claim focused on how each airline has these huge hubs where they control a lot of the traffic.
Right.
And on top of that, they can see each other's pricing in real time through those shared systems. So instead of like a backroom deal, the plaintiffs argue that the airlines can subtly signal their pricing intentions and react to each other without ever directly communicating.
So they're using the structure of the industry itself and the technology they all rely on to kind of manipulate prices in a less obvious way.
Exactly. It's like a tacit understanding rather than a blatant conspiracy.
Okay, that's starting to make sense. But here's the thing. With these two pretty complex allegations and millions of passengers, all with different tickets and different prices, how could a court even consider letting this proceed as a class action? I mean, that seems like a logistical nightmare.
You're hitting on the key legal question here. And it all boils down to Rule 23 of the Federal Rules of Civil Procedure, which sets out the rules for when a class action can happen.
Right. Rule 23, every law student's favorite.
Yeah, exactly. And the key here is that there has to be a question of law or fact that's common to the entire class, not just individual issues. So in this case, the court did something really clever. They divided the class certification process, which is called bifurcation.
Bifurcation. So they're basically splitting it into two parts.
Exactly. First, they looked at the request for an injunction, which falls under Rule 23b2. This basically means the plaintiffs were asking the court to order the airlines to stop this alleged price-fixing behavior.
Got it. So that's about stopping it from happening again in the future.
Yes, exactly. And for that part, the court said that even though passengers might have been overcharged by different amounts, they all had a common interest in making sure the airline market was fair and competitive.
Okay, that makes sense. But what about the other part, the part where passengers want to get some money back for being overcharged?
Right, so that falls under Rule 23b3, which deals with monetary damages.
And there, the big question is whether the common issues are more important than the individual differences, right?
Exactly. And this is where the plaintiffs brought in some really powerful evidence. They used an econometric model developed by their expert witness, a Dr. Beyer.
An econometric model. Sounds complicated.
It is, but essentially it uses statistical analysis to look at economic data and test different theories. And in this case, Dr. Beyer's model was designed to show that if these alleged conspiracies were happening, they would have resulted in a systematic pattern of overcharging.
So even though my ticket to, say, Chicago might have cost a different amount than your ticket to, say, Miami, Dr. Beyer's model argued that we both paid a certain percentage more than we should have in a fair market.
That's the gist of it. And the court found this model pretty convincing because it showed a common impact across all the passengers, even with all those individual fare differences.
So it's not about the specific dollar amount each person lost, but the overall effect on the market.
Precisely. And on top of that, the court also pointed out that at the end of the day, air travel is air travel.
Meaning
whether you're flying to Chicago, Miami, or wherever, the basic service is the same. Mm-hmm. Getting you from point A to point B.
Yeah.
So that further supported the idea of a common question, even with all the price variations.
Okay, so they had the econometric model, they had the argument about the standardized nature of air travel, and that got them past the hurdle for the damages part of the class action. But what about the airlines? I mean, they must have fought back hard against this whole thing. What did they say?
Oh, they definitely pushed back. Their big argument was that a class action with 12 and a half million people was just way too big.
Yeah.
It would be impossible to notify everyone and manage the case effectively.
That's a fair point. 12 and a half million people is a lot of people.
Right. They also kept saying that because everyone paid a different fare, there was no real common question of fact. But the court didn't buy it.
So how did the court address the airlines' concerns about the sheer size of the class and all those logistical issues?
They basically said, look, technology has come a long way. We've got these huge databases, airline reservation systems, credit card records. It's all there.
So there are ways to actually reach all those millions of people.
Right. And as for the fare differences, the court stuck to its guns, emphasizing that standardized nature of air travel and the strength of that econometric model.
Okay, I'm following. But was there anything else? Anything beyond the data and the commonality of air travel?
Yeah, there's one more thing. The court also looked at what are called plus factors. These are basically pieces of circumstantial evidence that, when you put them together with parallel conduct, can make collusion seem more likely.
Plus factors, huh? So we're talking about things that aren't direct proof of a secret agreement, but kind of add to the suspicion.
Exactly. So in this case, one example was that airline executives had made public statements about maintaining disciplined capacity growth.
Oh, so even things they said in public could be used as evidence.
Yeah, and you can see why. On the surface, talking about disciplined growth sounds like responsible business practice. But in the context of all the other evidence, the court saw it as a potential sign that they were trying to limit competition.
That's interesting. It makes you think twice about what executives say publicly, right?
For sure, especially in industries where there's already a lot of scrutiny.
Yeah.
So to cut a long story short, the court ultimately decided to certify the class action.
Wow, so 12 and a half million passengers all suing together. That's huge. But what happened next? Did they actually go to trial?
Well, not exactly. Between 2017 and 2019, Southwest and American decided to settle the claims against them. Southwest agreed to pay $15 million, and American settled for $45 million.
Okay, so that's two out of four airlines settling. And I remember reading that those settlements were structured as claims made, right? Can you remind us what that means?
Sure. In a claims-made settlement, passengers don't automatically get money. They have to actively submit a claim to get their share of the settlement fund.
So you couldn't just sit back and wait for a check to arrive in the mail?
Nope. If you had flown on Southwest or American during that time, you had to actually fill out a form and make your claim.
Interesting. Okay, so that's what happened with those two. What about Delta and United? Did they settle too?
No, they decided to keep fighting. Their main argument was that any capacity changes they made were just normal business responses to the economy, you know, things like changes in GDP. And they insisted there was no smoking gun, no proof of a real agreement to collude.
Makes sense that they'd try to defend themselves. So did the court buy their arguments? Did the case against them get dismissed?
Nope. In September of 2023, the court denied Delta and United's motions for summary judgment.
Okay, and remind me what summary judgment means.
Basically, it means the court says, look, there are no real factual disputes here, so we don't need a trial. I'm deciding this right now.
Got it. So by denying summary judgment, the court basically said, we need to keep going. There's enough evidence here for a jury to potentially side with the plaintiffs.
Exactly. The court again pointed to the fact that all four airlines made similar capacity adjustments and said that the plus factors, those bits of circumstantial evidence, were enough to make collusion seem plausible. They also said the plaintiff's economic analysis was strong enough to warrant a full trial to see if the alleged collusion actually hurt consumers.
Wow. So even without that direct evidence, the case against Delta and United is still alive.
That's right. It's ongoing.
This whole case is really fascinating. I think there's some really important lessons here for anyone interested in antitrust law and, you know, the complexities of litigation in general.
I agree. There's a lot to unpack.
Okay, so let's wrap up with those key takeaways for our listeners, especially for those who are still in law school. What are the most important things to glean from all of this?
Well, first, this case shows how you can strategically use different parts of Rule 23, both for stopping harmful behavior in the future and for getting damages for past harm.
So it highlights how flexible Rule 23 can be in tackling these big antitrust issues.
Absolutely. And second, this case really underscores just how critical economic analysis and expert testimony are in these types of cases.
Especially when you're dealing with something like price fixing, where there might not be a clear paper trail or a confession.
Exactly. Dr. Beyer's econometric model was essential in demonstrating the impact on consumers as a whole.
So a strong grasp of economics and data analysis is becoming more and more important for litigators.
No doubt about it.
What's the third big takeaway?
I'd say it's the importance of those plus factors. This case shows that the courts are paying attention to even subtle things, like public statements made by executives, especially when it comes to industries with only a few major players.
So it's not just about finding that one gotcha moment. It's about building a case using all the available pieces, right?
Right. And it's interesting to note that the court certified this massive class action before doing a deep dive into whether the expert testimony was admissible under what's called a Gobert review.
Ah, the Dobert standard, another legal hurdle. So basically, the court was willing to let the case move forward before fully vetting the experts' methods.
That's right. And that could tell us something about how courts are approaching these huge, complex class actions. They're not always waiting for every I to be dotted and every P to be crossed before letting the case proceed.
That's a really interesting point. And it leads us to a bigger question. I mean, if the court was willing to certify this massive class, even with the challenges of proving price fixing and all the nuances of how airlines set their fares, what does this mean for other industries?
Yeah, what about those industries where there are only a few big companies controlling the market?
Exactly. Does this case make it easier to hold those industries accountable through class actions, even when it's hard to find direct evidence of collusion?
It's a big question, and there are no easy answers. On the one hand, you have this need to make sure that consumers have a way to seek justice when they've been harmed by potentially illegal practices.
Right.
But on the other hand, you have to balance that against the challenges of managing these huge, complex cases and the potential burden on businesses.
It's a delicate balance for sure, and something that anyone interested in litigation, especially in the antitrust world, should be thinking about.
Absolutely. I think this case is just the tip of the iceberg, and we're going to see a lot more debate and development in this area in the years to come.
Well said. And that's a great place to leave it for today. Lots for everyone to think about. Thanks for joining me for this deep dive.
My pleasure. Always happy to talk shop.
And to all our listeners, thanks for tuning in to Lex Pug. We'll be back next time with another fascinating case that's shaping the legal landscape.